Oh, it's us. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
And I've got to tell you, at the top, we were going to have Olive. I want to call her Olive. I worked in West Africa where the women, I knew many named Olive. But this is Olive Sen, Sr., wrote the book, Dying to Better Ourselves, West Indians and the Building of the Panama Canal. By the way, a great book available at a different book list. Unfortunately, due to some family responsibilities, Olive is out of the city and out of our reach for this show, but she will be with us in the future, probably in the next week or two. She will be back and available. But it gives us a chance to keep on promoting the book itself, which you should get. Olive Sr. is a poet and historian. And this book, which I have been reading, Dying to Better Themselves, the West Indians and the Building of the Panama Canal, it is very eloquent. And Phil, you know this. Growing up in the North American environment, we thought that it was Teddy Roosevelt.
He built the Panama Canal, right?
And I
after the Frenchman failed, the American went in and did it.
The French failed, which probably had something to do with people wishing them to fail, because whoever controlled that isthmus had hit the jackpot. But so that's it's a very important story. I have to say that we all know that many lives were lost. But the picture, again, it's kind of like talking about World War II. The only lives that counted were those which were registered as North Americans or white. And the book really goes into great detail to give you the true picture of who labored all those years. And it's basically a story of more a half century, because they didn't start with a canal. They started with a railroad, building that. And so we will be doing that interview. And I just send our apologies because we had hoped to be able to do it this show. We mentioned a different book list. Now, on August the 26th at 7 p.m., Black Lives Matter, two spokespersons from that movement will be at 746 Bathurst Street. That's August the 26th at 7 p.m. And, you know, this is a movement which has really captured people's imagination. I see polls indicating that Black Americans registered to vote were asked about whether they think of that as an issue, and overwhelmingly thought it was high up on their list, top of the list in terms of importance. Shows you how quickly, you know, you go from Ferguson to the incidents in Baltimore, Chicago, every American city, but some of them have been really ugly, like the woman in Texas tasered, beaten up by police, and ultimately dead in a cell. And the leading candidates are being asked about this. And so now every week we have a discussion of what the latest candidate said. We had talked on this show, when are they going to have a meeting or a confrontation or action involving Hillary Clinton? Well, shortly after we mentioned it, it did occur. But it is one that you have to analyze and closely scrutinize, because there's so many takes on it. But I would recommend Black Agenda Report for broaching this subject. How do you deal with people who are trying, you know, will wish to exploit you to get themselves elected? And whereas your issue is this violent, broad-gauge violence against Black community, which exists in Canada as well as the United States, but in the United States, too, they're having an election. Incidentally, it hasn't come up here, and none of our candidates are discussing it, to my knowledge, though we do have a very vocal and healthy, vigorous Black Lives Matter movement, actually. Very well spoken. We've had them on this show. So, at any rate, that little encounter between Hillary Clinton and two representatives has been analyzed very in my view, persuasively by a Black Agenda report. By the way, Phil, did you happen to read that? Did you see
it? I haven't read this report, no. I was aware of the meeting, though, but...
Yeah. You didn't see it? Yeah. Did you see the encounter?
No.
Okay,
no.
It's available. That wasn't fair, was it?
No, it wasn't
Bring,
fair.
Put you, have you, you come in without any...
I actually was...
Lawyers are not supposed to do that.
No, but I was actually reading an article that has cataloged all of the shootings of Black Americans this year by the police, and 47 states have had at least one fatality. There's only three states that haven't, and two of those states don't have a major metropolitan area. So that was very interesting. 47 states out of 50 have had at least one, and of course, in many cases,
one
many
what?
More.
What are you talking about?
A killing of a black male by a policeman with his gun.
Right? Yeah.
That it's
this year.
This year, 2015. Yeah. Just this year, which is only two-thirds over. Right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, these things are actually, if you know, understand the statistics, are practically daily events. There is this matter of how Hillary handled it and also the manner in which it happened. This is a movement rather – it reminds me some ways of SDS in that a bunch of people crop – you know, they start building chapters. But, of course, you know, it's like anybody would tell you, you open a bunch of franchises and some of them are going to be able and – all that, and others will not, and it's going to be some growth problems. But Hillary was not picketed, and no one attempted to. There was no demonstration demanding that she use the term. As a matter of fact, I'm not aware of her using the term. I watched it, and it was an uncomfortable encounter. She's somewhat creepy the way she looked and folded her arms and leaned away from them, except when she wanted to make sure she was pointing. They always tell politicians, if there's a camera around, be sure you're pointing, because that, you know, it looks like you're in charge. So you'll see photographs of politicians. Often there'll be eight of them. They're all pointing. You're like, and you say, are you all of you speaking at once? Probably, actually. So you're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT. I haven't told you the high point. The major thing, we're going to be talking with Stephen Gowans a little later in a few minutes. Stephen Gowans has written three important articles on really very pertinent. One is on the condition of so-called democracy in America. They don't even have democracy now in America. It's all of the problems of money and gerrymandering and all the tricks that are played and the game of claiming you have multi-party democracy when basically you have two. And as Gore Vidal said, it is a left wing of the party and a right wing of the party, and it's the Democrats and Republicans. And it's been since the beginning of the country, by the way. And Paul Krugman of the New York Times has discovered that the Republicans seem to be dominated by money. And Stephen Gowans is impolite enough to point out that so are the Democrats.
Well, Krugman's still working on that one. He hasn't discovered it yet.
Krugman is hoping for an appointment. There's a discussion of that. The title involves a nice term, procedural democracy. But he also has and Gowans' publication is What's Left, and you find it gowans.wordpress.com. He has an article about the altercation between North Korea, as we tend to call it, it's the People's Republic, Democratic Republic of North Korea, People's Democratic Republic.
Democratic People's Republic.
We'll get there.
DPRK.
Yeah, it's a procedural something. And of North Korea and South Korea, which, you know, got attention because, in fact, the U.S. has 30,000 plus troops in South Korea. The United States, I might remind you, is a nuclear power. And North Korea happens also to have nuclear weapons. And the U.S. has 45,000 troops in Japan. And they have an annual military exercise, which if you listen to the Taylor Report, every year at August we find ourselves talking to Stephen Gowans because what they call a war game is always going on. And then they always say, oh, and there's something about North Korea. They seem to be upset. Yeah, you're flying warplanes along their border. Your ships are moving into their territory. You sometimes, as I recall an interview previous with Stephen Cowens, they were shelling an island, which was, as a part of their little game, the island is a disputed island. In other words, according to North Korea, it is their island. So if you're shelling it, you're basically slapping them to see what they will do. And then if they do anything, you mention, the Toronto Star will tell you that they're warlike. Or Hollywood will tell you that the leader is mad and you need to have his head explode in a movie. We're very, of course, you know, fair and all this stuff. We're just inundated with idiotic propaganda coming from Washington and Hollywood. Sometimes I can't tell which one's in charge. Is Hollywood wagging Washington and Washington wagging Hollywood? But they definitely are in, they work together. I've noticed that. And then his third topic, which we will be going into with Stephen, is Cuba and the question of the access to the internet, where the New York Times and the Washington Post and Los Angeles Times, Toronto Star, Globe Mail will tell you that the Cubans envy us so much and that they just are so tantalized and so they can't wait to be like us. And they want that internet access, and they just don't have it, you know, the way we have it. Well, Gowans has produced some interesting facts which show something different, and I'm going to leave it for him to tell. But it's going to be a good story and important. Now, I have boxing news, which bears on matters to do with our program. Roy Jones, Jr., I wouldn't call him Jr. to his face, Roy Jones, one of the greatest prize fighters, pound for pound, we love that expression, but in his case, it's true, of our time. A man who was a middleweight champion, a light heavyweight champion, and he actually defeated the sitting champion, a man, I think his name was Rodriguez, a Mexican-American heavyweight. He fought him in China, by the way. He defeated him. And so he won all those titles. Well, over the weekend, he was in, of all places, Crimea. And he had tea with Putin. And he asked Putin if he could get a Russian passport. Because he says he, Roy, the entrepreneur who's worth a lot of money, I hope, I think it's true, says he does a lot of business in Russia. He is also an entertainer. And so he asked that he be given a passport, and Putin says, "Well, if you stay here and you do your work, if that's, I don't see why there'd be a problem." But there was a problem in Ukraine. And Kiev was not happy, and so Kiev said he's persona non grata, can't come to Ukraine. I don't remember Roy saying he ever wanted to go. I can't think of a good reason why, but. So you think, well, now, you know, is Roy getting into deep water here? I mean, he's talking to Putin. There's a lovely picture of Roy with Putin. Putin, as you know, is a judo guy, very good at it. And Roy, already I told you, is a champion. So you say, well, Roy, I'm watch out, because, you know, you're going to go through your tax forms with a fine-tooth comb, and they're going to, and you're, you know, Roy might be headed into what we call deep water. But he seems to be relishing it, because when the government of Ukraine said, well, Roy, you were in Crimea where you can't go there without our permission, he said, oh, that's just Vlad and Vitaly, the two Ukrainian heavyweight fighters, who, by the way, when they were champions, he used to tell us they were Russian, because I think they sold more tickets. People, if you call them Ukrainians, 30% drop in ticket sales. So if you make him the bad Russians, which is what they were happy to do, then they make a lot more money. Everybody makes more money. So Roy says, I think Vlad and Vitaly are looking for trouble with me. He says, I think they'd like to fight me. And he said, I'd be quite happy. Let's arrange a fight in Crimea. They come to Crimea and I'll fight them. I think he could beat Vlad. I wouldn't put him in the ring with Vitaly, but... It is it shows that Roy's fast on his feet, politically and otherwise. And I take my hat off to him. Good for you, Roy. You went to Crimea and you had tea with Putin and you asked for a passport. We're not going to hear the end of this for a while because boxing is still an exciting sport in the United States, and there are the people who make a lot of money on it. I'm really quite surprised that the business with which Roy is associated, he does commentary. I don't know if you know this, Phil, but he does regular boxing commentary. So one wonders, will he have a contract when he returns home? He might have, because from a boxing business point of view, the fighters are in the East now. And the greatest fighters are the heavyweights. That's where the money is. That's where all the prestige is. The heavyweight champion of the world is the dominant fighter. I have full respect for Floyd Mayweather as a fighter, but he would not dare get in the ring with heavyweights. And heavyweights are coming from the East. So the company with which Roy is associated, they're probably thinking of the future, and they want to get some of these guys. And Roy is talking about training people, too, by the way. He had a great career. I recommend you go and look at him. You want to see a beautiful fighter. He's one of those very few that I've ever seen who could duplicate something done by Benny Leonard, the greatest lightweight fighter ever, one of the great Jewish fighters. There was a time when Jewish fighters dominated particularly the lower weight divisions. And Benny Leonard was the best. Benny Leonard told his manager once, he's in the corner between rounds, and he says, "I'm going to win this round, but I'm not going to throw a punch." And the guy said, "Well, that's impossible." He said, "No. One of the things they didn't talk like this in the corner, but he pointed out that ring generalship, you get a point for that. That's one of the things you're looking for. Who's in command of the fight? It's called generalship. And boxers can do that. They take a big guy who's trying to hit him, and the boxer moves away from him. If he does it well enough, it's called ring generalship, you get a point. So he went out, and the guy didn't land a punch on him, and he controlled, and so he won the round without throwing a punch. And Roy Jones could do that kind of thing. He used to spend a couple of rounds saying to the guy, "Here I am, hit me." And the guy would swing. And, of course, as you know, the problem is subjective. Once you miss three or four times, then you become an absolute idiot. Then you're thinking, maybe I'll tackle him or I'll throw my shoe, because you're being embarrassed in front of a bunch of people. So instead of getting better, you get worse. And then he takes full advantage of you.
You know, I'm thinking there's a political analogy to ring generalship in the part of the world where Jones is visiting, because it strikes me that President Putin is a bit of a ring general, too. He doesn't have to throw a punch, and he just makes these other guys look like idiots.
Yeah, he says, "Why don't we take this up at UN? I have a motion here that could solve your little problem in Yemen." And they say, "Oh, no, we'd rather just keep bombing and shooting ourselves in the foot and making idiots." But he proposes all the way. This thing with Iran, the peace agreement, well, they needed the Russians for that. And the Russians were there. This Americans are tearing themselves up over, well, did we make a mistake or all that? Well, you better remember there were other countries involved, with Russia being the most important. Because one of the consequences, now that we're on that subject, of that is that Russia said, "Okay, you have your agreement. So, yes, to the Islamic Republic of Iran, those missiles you wanted, you got them." And people say, "I don't know, wait a minute, was that in the deal?" And the Russians said, "Of course. You said you needed this, if they didn't sign that agreement, of course, all these things were off, but that you signed. So now we will go to, that." And they will. And the British have opened the embassy. The flag has gone up. Yeah. And there's be a bunch of U.S. businessmen saying, "Hurry, hurry, hurry," because a lot of very lucrative deals are being signed. Now, just the last thing here before we go to get our friend, speak to our friend Stephen Gowans, I want to tell you, read to you something. Langston Hughes is one of the great authors, American authors. Because he's black, Americans are largely not aware of him, but he happens to be one of the great American poets. And he visited Cuba in the 1930s. Now, the United States is resuming talking about, hasn't really got off the dime, really. They still have the embargo, et cetera. And John Kerry went to Cuba and said, we want you to have a democracy. We want you to return to the, you know, the fold, and et cetera. And so I was looking at Langston Hughes, who visited Cuba in 1930 as a black American. And he wanted to go to the beach in Havana. And so he walked up to the ticket counter, where there's only one beach at Havana. And he says, I want two tickets. And he shoved the money back through the wicket. You'll have to see the manager. I can't sell them to you. Same sort of treatment has been meted out to me so often in Kansas and Boston and Birmingham that I began to understand. This is Langston Hughes talking, American poet. I went to the entrance gate and asked the attendant there to kindly call the manager for me. Instead, he called a bouncer. The bouncer was an American boxer. We're staying on our boxer theme. White, of course, with cauliflower ears and a flat nose. What do you guys want? This place ain't for you, he said. You can't come in. Do you mean to tell me that you're drawing a color line on a Cuban beach against American citizens, and you're an American yourself? And at this point, his friend, he had a friend with him who wanted to get into a fight. He told him, no, don't fight. Then the pug says, get out, he said, or I'll send for the police. Go ahead, I said. Send for them. The bouncer retired. A Cuban attendant permitted me to enter the lobby where there was a telephone. I called a friend, and he said he was going to come down. And then he said, they came over to him, and they said, you can't sit here. Why? I asked. The manager says you can't. And he says, let him know that he can arrest us. Get our friends who are Cubans for help. And then he says to them, get the manager for me, I requested of the officer. He went out and shortly returned with the manager, a tall, patronizing American white man. I began to explain to the manager why we had come to the beach, but he interrupted to say that he would not be allowed to stay within, and insisted that we leave the lobby at once. I said that since it was a public lobby, we would wait there for our friends. The manager declared he would have us ejected, and he went away. Shortly, a car sped up rapidly to the entrance, came to a halt, and four policemen with sabers drawn, jumped out. They came running toward us, and as if they intended to slice us into minced meat. Get out, they said, get out. In the face of such weapons, there's nothing to do. So they went outside. So the management was apparently satisfied. The police got back into the car and sped away. But shortly, the ex-pug appeared again, and he commanded us to leave the area. Scram, get going. I'll report this to the American consulate, I said. I'll remind their listeners. This is Langston Hughes, black American author, his memoirs. I'll report this to the American consulate. Report it, cried the pug with a series of oaths. Go ahead. They won't do nothing. I knew American consulates had seldom been known to fight for the battles of colored citizens abroad, Jim Crow, if Jim Crow was involved. So then his friend, of course, once again wanted to fight, and he, Langston Hughes, prevented it. And then a few moments, with a wail of sirens, a large police van swept down the road, stopped in front of us, and a dozen cops leaped out, armed to the teeth. This time, we were surrounded, hustled into the patrol wagon, and carried off to the nearest station. It happened that the station was in charge of a Negro captain, an enormous, very dark-colored man, who listened to the officer's charges against us, wrote them down in his book, and refused to lock us up. Wait here for your friends, he said gently. This is outrageous. But it is what happens to colored people in Cuba, where white Americans are in control. This is not the first time. There's been trouble at the Havana Beach. So following this, they're taken to a judge, and he said to the court. And the next morning, the beach authorities sent several Cuban attendants, whom we'd never seen, to present their side of the case to the judge. The attendants swore that Mr. Ingram and I had come into the beach cafe in our wet bathing suits, had put our feet upon the tables, had used profane language, and had otherwise misbehaved to the discomfort of all the more genteel tourists and bathers. The judge, a kindly old mulatto gentleman who might have been termed a Negro had he lived in the United States, but who was white in Havana, looked at the beach attendants sternly and said, "These gentlemen, I am sure, never set foot on your beach at all. They had no opportunity to change into their bathing suits. They had not been in the water. The police report indicates that they were arrested fully clothed on the streetcar platform outside. I believe their statement that you refused to sell tickets to them, and do not believe your fabrications. What you have done is against the tenets of Cuban hospitality and against Cuban law, which recognizes no differences between race or color. These guests on our shores have suffered enough at your hands and deserve an apology. Case dismissed." That's not a lovely story. That's from Langston Hughes. Of course, the sad part is, or sadder, is that his friend came and picked him up and then took him to a dinner. But he did not go to that beach. The beach remained a segregated beach run by Americans. And so when Kerry and everybody else talks about Cuba and getting back to something, this is a place the Cuban Revolution has cut you off from. You cannot do this anymore. And if we had been reading Langston Hughes all along instead of segregating him and repressing him and taking passports away from him, not letting him publish, not letting him win prizes. If we had listened all along, we wouldn't be in this crazy spot. But John Kerry never lifted a finger for such people as Langston Hughes, and he's not on John Kerry's reading list.